Hey, Edwin. How
Thank
are
you
you?
for doing Michael Bay, man. Finally, we're doing some real cinema.
What?
He picked Michael Bay, man. We're talking about the Bayham.
I didn't pick it. This was Craig's decision. I wanted to talk about Steven Spielberg's 9/11 movies this week, but
I got denied.
Well, good.
Do you like Michael Bay? Is that what we're fucking
out? I love Michael Bay. I love Michael Bay. I worship the Bay. I got the fucking Criterion of Armageddon. Those suckers, Connor.
It's an interesting decision.
This is an art house. If Criterion did not put this out, then what is it, man?
Welcome to Secret Movie Club Podcast 29. One before our Dirty 30. We're grateful you're here. Today, we are going to be talking about Michael Bay and Bayhem. As I was just saying before we started recording to our special guest, who you're going to find out about in a second, we want this podcast and whatever we do not just to be about sort of safe, canonical things that most people agree. It's also got to be about cinema and movies that people love and other people hate, and we got to get into it. Sometimes that's the most interesting. And Michael Bay is commercially one of the most successful movie makers of the last 30 years. Critically, pretty divisive. There are those people who totally defend Bay, and there are other people who are pretty much driven crazy by Bay's style, but we're going to get into it. But Bay is definitely a fascinating singular cinematic character on the scene. Who is with us today? Let us start with our special guest. Give it up for stand-up comedian Jay Light. Jay.
Hi. Hey, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Jay, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a stand-up comic out here in Los Angeles. I've been here in LA about 8 years. I'm a writer and film lover and sometimes film hater, but mostly just for my podcast, Blockbusting, where we talk about movies that people hate and why they hate them.
And if people want to listen to Blockbusting, where could they go?
They can go wherever they get podcasts. I'm on all the platforms, Spotify, iTunes, the other ones, Podbean. That's one, I think.
Yeah, we're on Podbean.
There you go. So, I just got onto the Indian podcasting platforms, Ghana, and there's some other one.
Oh, nice.
People are going to be able to tap in. Maybe I'll get some Bollywood requests.
Oh, sweet. So, Jay, it's wonderful to have you. We don't have to worry about you because you have your own podcast. So you're gonna be ready to go from moment one. Who else is with us?
Hey, it's Connor. If I saw this crap happen in a spaceship, I'd be like, hey, Armageddon out of here.
Hello, America. It's me. Talking about the Bayham.
That's all you need to know. I love that you just introduced yourself with pronouns. I'm going to respect that. And I'm Craig, founder, programmer of Secret Movie Club. So announcements, guys. We are just about, in fact, when you hear this, we will be in October 2020. And COVID be damned, we're doing our annual month-long Halloween-a-thon. It's going to be all scary movies, hardcore horror movies, family-friendly Halloween movies. And we're going to try to do a big spectrum of them. So everything from, you know, Get Out and Cabin in the Woods, some modern stuff, to Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho and George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, to classic 70s, which I'm going to talk about in a second, to family stuff like Coco, Nightmare Before Christmas, Addams Family. So we would love for you to check it all out. We're actually going to try to announce our entire October this week. So by the time you can go to secretmovieclub.com, you can go to our Eventbrite, which is probably the smartest place to go because that's where you buy the tickets. Just go Secret Movie Club Eventbrite. You should see all of October and November 1st, which is Day of the Dead. So I always consider our season, actually, it goes through November 2nd because those are the 2 days of Day of the Dead. And we're going to end with Coco, Pixar's Coco, literally about Day of the Dead. On Friday, which is when you'll hear this, we should be at Glendale for the rest of the month. God willing, as much as I learn a lot going to different parking lots, it is work intensive to do this stuff. And I would like to be at one parking lot for a month. So I hope we are. The Glendale, which has basically been our home for 2 months. On Friday, we are going to kick off with Poltergeist, the original Toby Hooper, 1982. Some would say ghost directed by Steven Spielberg. We who did the story and produced it. That's probably
ghost.
That's probably its own podcast. I have my own opinions about it. Suffice it to say, there is an incredibly intricate 8-minute single one-er before they enter the room in the middle of the movie. And Toby Hooper never did a one-er like that. So that's sort of a dead giveaway that something was going on, because Spielberg does that all the time. Nevertheless, I think Toby Hooper had a lot to do with it, but we'll talk about that in another podcast. We're doing Poltergeist and then The Lost Boys. So we're doing a double dose of 80s horror. On Saturday, we're actually going to do a double dose of low budget 70s horror. We're doing the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre with Toby Hooper, definitely directed all by his lonesome. And I think is one of the greatest horror movies of all time. So
absolutely.
You know, I was going to say, like, I hope people don't misunderstand me. Toby Hooper, if he made nothing else but the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, basically made one of the greatest movies of all time. So
part two, man.
It's part two. He did Life Force. Toby Hooper did a lot. We can talk about a lot. Did Eaten Alive, and he did Funhouse, which is like incredible. But anyway, we're doing Texas Chainsaw Massacre with the original Phantasm, Don Coscarelli's 1979 Phantasm, which was partially shot in my backyard. Drop that, and then I'm going to leave that. My uncle, David Brown, was the art director on that movie, and maybe we'll talk about that. Yeah, and I got a whole story about it being shot in my backyard, but we'll go to that another time. And then on Sunday, our family Sunday, will be E.T., which Edwin vehemently feels I should not have programmed, but E.T. takes place at Halloween. And I'm doing
it's
it.
Not
and
a horror movie.
I don't
it's
care, Edwin.
It's a horror movie.
I love it. I love Spielberg.
People care.
All right, it's got candy in it. It's around Halloween.
Calm down, Edwin. You're stressing me out.
You're stressing me out, Connor.
Edwin, for someone who prides himself on knowing trivia, I'm surprised you didn't notice what I did with the weekend. I want you to think about why I programmed ET, given the other things I just said. Let's see how long it takes you to get there, because I'm going to announce the last thing we're doing, which is Thursday, October 8th. We are inaugurating some cult horror film Thursdays, and we are doing Death Proof, Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof.
Yes! Yes!
So I brought Edwin back. We're doing the extended, the 113-minute version, and then we are following that up with Stephen King, the only movie ever directed, Maximum Overdrive. So we are doing two vehicular horror movies, and that is our first official week, and then I'm going to finalize the rest over the next few days. Edwin, did you figure out why I programmed ET this weekend?
No, I'm lost, man.
In 1981 and 82, Steven Spielberg directed and produced two movies at the same time.
Wait.
Oh, no, you wait, homie. They were E.T. and Poltergeist. They were released at the same time.
Bitch. Why
now, how did
you
not figure that out?
And Edwin, they were shot on some similar locations, Simi Valley and elsewhere. And here's a ridiculous monetary fact, which, by the way, money is the last thing you ever should think of just in terms of filmmaking. I really do believe that. So I'm not somebody who's always talking about box office grosses. But I will say this. Crazy fact, E.T., Poltergeist were both released the summer of 82, and there was like 2 weeks where Steven Spielberg in 1982 was making $1 million a day. So I just want people to like let that sit with you for a little bit. Like for a month, he was pulling in $1 million a day, which is just crazy to me. In 1982 dollars. I know, Jay.
Why didn't I see that?
Another thing you don't know.
I knew about it, but it didn't sink into my head yet.
Yeah, so guess what, Edwin? Sometimes I theme these things with thoughtfulness. So when you bag on E.T. next time, I want you to think about what's around E.T. and contextualize.
We're talking about E.T. next week.
Son of a bitch.
Okay. So anyway, this is a more lively intro than normal. But anyway, that's our first week. You can find out about everything on secretmovieclub.com. And also, if you have any emails about our lengthy, wordy intros that you wish we would cut down, you can also email us at community@secretmovieclub.com or podcast@secretmovieclub.com. And finally, this week, we are launching our third Secret Movie Club Radio Hour, Daniel Ott's The Ballad of the Sin Eater. We should have that to you on Thursday, we think. We're putting some final touches on it. So by the time you hear this on Friday, you will definitely get another dose of Radio Hour narrative cinema for your ears. All right, enough. This weekend, we showed as part of our disaster derby, because September was so disastrous, I just said, F it. The last weekend of September, we're just doing disaster movies. And I tried to program it with an arc. We started Intense, War of the Worlds, which rewatching it is like an R-rated horror movie.
War of the Worlds?
The Spielberg War of the Worlds. Edwin spent the whole movie just going like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
I'm never watching that movie again. I'm not.
I've mentioned in the past that it's one of my favorite Spielberg movies. I think it's, as a horror guy, I think it's maybe one of the scariest movies ever made.
I have to say, having now seen it a number of times, although I have some issues with the Tim Robbins stuff and some issues with the very end of the movie, easily one of the best things Spielberg has ever done. It only gets more horrifying and
the
better.
The car scene?
Oh, the car scene's the best scene in the movie. And it has none of the aliens. That's what's amazing about it. It's about us. That car scene has nothing to do with the aliens invading. Has to do with us losing our minds.
I prefer cuddly alien E.T. Spielberg to War of the Worlds. Spielberg's one of those directors who I've never liked the way he makes me feel uncomfortable. I like when he's doing things that are like cool and tension building, but in a way where it's like exciting as opposed to War of the Worlds, just like Cormac McCarthy-ish.
Well, he was mad about the Iraq war that year. So
yeah, that's fair. It's understandable.
I think Spielberg serves as a good comparative to Michael Bay. And one thing that I would say would be, you know, there's definitely the people who prefer, as you said, optimistic Spielberg, blockbuster optimistic Spielberg, to the dark, you know, when he goes dark. And we'll probably have to do that a podcast for another time. Suffice it to say, though, we did this disaster derby where we did War of the Worlds, Cloverfield, which actually both
Cloverfield.
Yeah, fairly intense. And I had forgotten how down Cloverfield ends, really. And then on Saturday, we started to bring in the light, Armageddon. Then we did Airplane, which seems quaint now as a disaster spoof, because it's really just a plane that's having some problems. There's like fog. You're like, wow, compared to those other movies. And then on Sunday, we ended with Pixar's The Incredibles, where a family saves the world from disaster. Nevertheless, we did Armageddon as our Saturday night. I'll just get to it right at the beginning. I'm not a huge Michael Bay fan. I've only seen three of his movies, but I recognize and have always recognized him as somebody of supreme cinematic talent. I think anybody who says he doesn't have cinematic talent isn't paying attention to the movies. I was watching Armageddon, and like the amount of effort and work that went into every single one of those shots, you may not like them. You may not like his aesthetic, but like that guy works hard. But what was funny was, here's what I'm getting at. Of all the movies we did this weekend, and let's put Pixar Incredibles to the side because that sold out. Of the other ones I said, the most attended was Armageddon. Armageddon was easily, of all the movies I just mentioned, had the biggest audience, even though we did okay on the other ones. People were there and they were into it. So it reminded me that Michael Bay taps into something that people want to come and see. Now,
literally right before we started recording, I just wrapped up the first time I ever watched Armageddon. Like, I finished watching it at 1 o'clock this afternoon. It's 1:45 now. And I've seen a couple Bay movies, you know, of course, the first couple Transformers and Pain and Gain are the ones that really come to mind for me. There is something to be said about, like, Michael Bay is the kind of director who you want to hate everything that he does because of just the way he is. He's blustery, he's bombastic. He has, like, this crazy obsession with the military-industrial complex. Like, yeah, I've never seen...
the only pro-Benghazi movie.
Yeah! I mean, I rewatched Transformers, I think it was like a year or two ago, but half of that movie is basically just war propaganda. It's just like a military recruiting training video, and just like, oh, also you might get to fight alongside Optimus Prime if you play your cards right. But there's something to be said about like the energy that you get watching a Michael Bay movie. He's an auteur in his own way, in a way that a lot of people making blockbusters exclusively pretty much don't really have. Like, it's weird to look at somebody whose whole filmography you look at and you say that Pain and Gain is the most thoughtfully made movie of the entire filmography.
How is Pain and Gain? I haven't seen it, but I have an editor friend who is mostly a foreign film guy. You know, he's a Fassbender and Jean Renoir, and he actually said Pain and Gain was good.
Yeah, I like Pain and Gain. It's got something to it. It doesn't feel quite as over the top in terms of, at least, like, there's obviously not really a whole lot of the kinds of explosions or crazy high stakes drama that you'd come to expect from watching other Michael Bay movies. It's a much smaller story. You know, Michael Bay tends to do stuff that's like got jokes in it. He said himself, right? He's making movies for teenage boys. So the sense of humor in the movies is always very like geared at teenage boys and very juvenile and very just like, oh, she's hot, isn't she? Oh, but man, I think I might have farted into my spacesuit. And it's stuff like that, right? But Pain and Gain is like Mark Wahlberg and The Rock actually being, I think, good satire for once, which is weird in a Michael Bay movie. Like, it's a good satire of gym culture and of just the kind of idiots that I don't know. It's a farce. I would never have expected Michael Bay to make a good farce.
Someone described it to me as like Michael Bay's Fargo,
which I thought was sort of like interesting.
I said it.
Edwin said it. Sorry. We're going to keep talking about Armageddon, but any initial thoughts on Armageddon since it's fresh for you?
I love Billy Bob Thornton in it. There's a couple of characters, even movies that I don't particularly think are like great movies. And I will say this. I do think Armageddon's not a great movie, but it's a very fun movie and it was a very interesting movie. There are definitely parts that I was cool with having it on as background noise and not pausing and rewatching and paying close attention to. But there's also a lot of stuff in there where it's interesting visually, and the characters, some of them are one note, but some of them you get a little bit of complexity in there. And sure, maybe the complexity is not through their dialogue. Maybe you have to have a shot of, say, a brace on somebody's leg in order to build out the complexity of a character that they can't just show off themselves through their dialogue. But there's something to it that's just like, it's captivating. And I think Michael Bay really understands how to make spectacle, but also make it digestible, which is it's tough to pull off.
Armageddon is one of the best action movies ever made.
All right.
It's
amazing. I've seen it like 10 times when it was on Netflix. It's amazing. It's the most patriotic American movie ever. Let me just say first, my favorite Bay movie is The Rock. That's my personal favorite. Pearl Harbor can go to hell because I hated that movie so damn much. But Armageddon, though. Armageddon is amazing. Bruce Willis is amazing. Ben Affleck is great. I don't like Liv Tyler. Steve Buscemi at his height of his game being a psycho. Billy Bob Thornton, who clearly does not want to be in the movie because I read on the trivia that he did not like it. And Michael Bay was being an on set, told Ben Affleck to shut up because Affleck told him something to him.
Michael Bay contains multitudes and what we're going to have to talk about. Just real quickly to set you up. It is well documented that Michael Bay is considered to be as hard a director to work with as James Cameron because of how exacting he is on what he wants. Now, whether or not you like what he does, he drives actors insane and he drives his crews insane. This is well documented.
I will say the sets are incredible for a movie like this.
Yeah, practical effects. A lot of practical effects.
I noticed they use a lot of miniature sets, which really work pretty damn well. It's very intense, like when they lose the drill, but it gets happy when Ben Affleck just shows up. But, you know, it's a fun, fun movie. It's not great for everyone, but man, Michael Bay made a hell of a movie. It's great. Aerosmith, they got an Oscar nomination.
So Michael Bay has a fascinating personal story. He didn't know who his dad was for a while, and it was actually really believed, and he believed it himself, that his father might have been John Frankenheimer, the famous director of The Manchurian Candidate, Seconds, and some great car chase movies. And Frankenheimer himself is known as a real muscular action director, but sort of like the thinking man's 60s action director.
Seconds is incredible.
I think that a genetic test happened that disproved it, and Frankenheimer would like disown patriarchy there, but it's still an open question if he actually is the son of another director, which I always found interesting. Bay comes out of that school like David Fincher and many other people, Gore Verbinski. He got his start in commercials and music videos. He actually directed the really famous Got Milk commercials of the 90s. Those are Bay's, like, where the one guy knows the trivia answer is Aaron Burr, but he's eating peanut butter and he doesn't have milk. That's actually a Michael Bay commercial, believe it or not. I know, yeah. Michael Bay graduated from Art Center, which is here in Southern California. I'm unplugging this damn phone. Give me a second.
Hell yeah. Off the grid.
All right. I'm talking Michael Bay, whoever you are.
Blow it up, man. Just go Michael Bay. Just blow it up.
But he comes out of Art Center, which is here in Pasadena. So too to come Zack Snyder, which is no surprise to me. One of the things I've noticed in every Bay movie I've seen is an incredible understanding of color, which even some of our other great directors don't have. I was laughing because if you watch Armageddon, and Jay, you just watched it, whenever a scene is coated in blue, there's one yellow object. Whenever a scene is coated in green, there's one red object. And that's the color wheel. And so what he's doing is literally like tripping our lizard brain with color. And it was just sort of funny to see how that was. I have seen Armageddon, The Rock, and Bad Boys 2. I said this before, but I mean this. I fear Michael Bay in the Old Testament way, by which I mean, when you talk about a fear of God in the Old Testament, be you a Jew or a Catholic or whatever, you're talking about a respect of something that you don't take lightly. You know, you fear the flood, or you fear the wrath, or you fear whatever. I fear Michael Bay in the sense that I'm not going to sit here and bag on him in this sense. I watched Armageddon, and every single shot, the camera is whipping, things are sparking, things are breaking, actors are moving. If you make movies, you know that that's really hard to do. And most filmmakers reserve that kind of filmmaking for their action sequences. And the rest of the movie is literally shot like, you know, singles and coverage and whatever. I sat there watching 2.5 hours, even when he's doing a dialogue scene between Bruce Willis and Billy Bob Thornton. Like, the camera's whipping, it's color coded. He's shot like 4 different angles, but he's thought about it. He's doing an A and a B camera. So I fear Michael Bay in the sense that he knows what he's doing for what he wants to do. That being said, I also have to say, I feel like watching Michael Bay movies is like eating a meal that looks delicious and it kind of tastes delicious. But then at the end of it, you're like, but something was off about that meal. I didn't get out of it.
It's made from human.
Yeah, Michael Bay's Soylent Green for sure.
Yeah, there's something about it where at the end of it, you're like, just it didn't fill me up. I feel a little weird. That felt a little button pushing, and it just wasn't the satisfying meal that a Jaws is, or that if we're talking about big movies, even in Aliens, a James Cameron. Like, if you're asking me who the big movie makers are, I will watch Spielberg anytime, and I think he's amazing. I will watch James Cameron anytime, and I always get something out of Cameron. Peter Jackson, I'm there. Michael Bay, I fear. Old Testament way, but I can't say that I'm always running out to see the next Michael Bay thing. When I see anything really propagandistic on either side of the spectrum, I don't like it. I don't like that in my cinema. I don't want to be lectured to about what to believe. And I do not like the constant American flag, slow motion dudes, like anti-intellectual. Michael Bay is always making fun of thinking people. I don't know if you noticed this in Armageddon, Jay, but like the thinking people get slapped around. And like, you don't know what you're talking. The scientists, the people who've devoted 20 years to like, how are we going to do this? We can only be saved
by like these right wing miners who know nothing about space.
Right. With Bruce Willis yelling at the scientists about like, this is how you actually put a drill on, you bunch of numbnuts. Get your stuff. Come on. Didn't teach you that one in NASA school, did they?
I will say this because I don't disagree. I do feel like in this one, there is at least a little bit of a balance in that the one dude, Jason Isaacs' character, is like, I'm the smarter guy. You guys got to listen to me. Like, we have to do it this way. And he's believed because he's like had like better grades or whatever. And then later on, Billy Bob Thornton, who is that guy, is like on the same team as Bruce Willis, and the straight military people are kind of the bad guys in some of those scenes. So I do think it's not quite as intense as
when Keith David's character is given the order and he's like, they're like, oh, I got to follow it blindly. But then, No, that's going to put everybody at risk. You can't do that.
I totally agree with you guys. I think that this one feels a little more balanced than certain movies like that. I've seen only Transformers 2, which I saw in theaters and don't remember other than the robot balls. And I remember the military stuff because those are pretty like pure military. Like essentially it's the what if the Transformers teamed up with a teenage boy and the military. Mm-hmm. I saw The Island, which I don't remember any of, and I've definitely been in a room with a friend with a VHS copy of Pearl Harbor while we discussed talking about watching it. I don't remember if we watched it or not, but suffice it to say, this is the first Michael Bay movie I've seen in like a decade. It's probably the one I've liked the most. In the past, probably the two directors I've talked the most harsh about are Zachary Snyder and Chris Nolan. And while I like Nolan more than Bay and Snyder less, I do think Bay annoys me less because unlike them, I don't think Bay is like trying to pretend like his movies are super smart or anything. Like he is very aware of the demographic he's going for and the ideas he's going for. And so that doesn't get me. I also think it's interesting. I think you kind of touched on this earlier, Jay. You talked about with Christopher Nolan, the idea of like he's a director who's making these huge movies exactly how he wants. I think you kind of have to extend the same thing to Bay. Like it seems like he's making these movies how he wants to make them.
Yeah, I would say
it's just that his style is extremely commercial. But I think like Snyder, while I think they're really good at composition and visual storytelling, I personally kind of don't think they're good at cinematic storytelling. The differentiation there being cinematic implying like editing and movement as opposed to just individual images. The action scenes in this movie, I just tune out. I'm like, I can't tell what is happening. I mean, one, everyone's dressed the same, so that's not good. Like, I'm sorry, Edwin, I literally like while watching the movie, I could not parse what I was seeing. And I think the most important thing if you're doing an action movie is being able to make sense of the action. I think if you can't do that, you've like fundamentally kind of failed. And it's a bummer because I like the other stuff. I like how dumb the other stuff is. I like how earnest it is. It reminds me of another series I've talked about very fondly on this podcast, which is the Fast and Furious series. You complain about CG, Edwin, and you like Michael Bay. Yeah. The Fast and Furious series, I can parse what happens in those action scenes. I can see those and I go, that's Ludacris's car and he's doing that over there. And when he goes up on the wall, that does this thing that affects that. My brain can make sense of it. While watching Bay's action scenes, with a few exclusions, I'm genuinely lost and I don't know what's going on. And that makes me, it's not that I'm mad at Michael Bay, I'm disappointed.
So the funny thing that I was joking about with myself was watching Armageddon, I felt that the movie should have just been called like Color Spark Slow-Mo, because I felt like whenever you didn't know what to do, just have some vivid color, some sparks, and put it in slow motion. Even when they didn't need sparks, I almost want to make a Michael Bay movie where it takes place in like 19th century Victorian England, and it's just all around a dining room table, and they're talking about the Magna Carta or something. And then when like it's not going to work, it's just like slow-mo sparks color. And actually, real quick, so Armageddon, the basic premise is an asteroid's going to come and destroy Earth. For some reason, the only people who can save us are a group of oil riggers who are really good at drilling. And so they get trained by NASA, put in a spaceship to blow up the asteroid. And then the B story, or the A story, depending on how you see it, is Bruce Willis is the father of Liv Tyler. And Bruce Willis's like hotshot protege is Ben Affleck. And he and Liv Tyler are in love. And Bruce Willis can't really deal with it because he's a protective dad. Suffice it to say, those family dynamics are going to come to play in the third act when sacrifices must be made. And so given that that's the heart of Armageddon, one of the things that I am really thinking about these days, and it goes to our politics as well, is you hear a lot of people complaining, how could that work? How could they believe that? How could they this or that? And if you tried to just be an alien, like imagine you're not political, just take yourself out of politics. You're an alien that you come to the planet. You might actually say, well, wait, this one person is being real simple to understand. This one person is saying things in five words. And you know what? Whether or not you agree with those five words, he's saying it over and over and over and over again. And the message is clear. So the largest number of people are getting this message. This other person is giving answers in 500 words or 1,000 words. And they think that they're being concise, but I'm losing it. I'm tuning out. It seems like this person who's saying it in five words understands politics better than this person who's saying it in 1,000 words. And I think with Michael Bay filmmaking, I was watching all these people come to the theater and I was like, okay, well, whether or not I agree with Michael Bay or like his aesthetic, he's easy to understand. Everybody gets the story. They feel good. These guys are going to go. They feel the emotion of the sacrifice. There's no ambiguity in that. And so what do you guys think about the argument that maybe Michael Bay understands what a majority of folks want, which is real simple storytelling, and that maybe we, the film nerds, don't get it, and we're not making movies, and he is. I'm playing devil's advocate here. We're not making movies, and he is, because he gets it, and we don't.
I think
don't.
There are other filmmakers who also do very well that make better movies.
Yeah, I'd agree. I agree with Connor on that. I think there's something about the way that Michael Bay makes movies, and I noticed it really, really prominently in Armageddon, whereas there were things that would happen, and somebody would say something out loud immediately or very quickly after I had thought the exact same thing.
Like, this is a so realistic nightmare.
Yeah, or why do you have a gun in space? By the way, we should have just called this movie Guns in Space. That's another great alternate title for it. But something about like Michael Bay, I mean, you brought up Christopher Nolan earlier, Connor, and I think that Chris Nolan makes smart movies for dumb people. He makes movies so dumb people can feel smart while they're watching it. Michael Bay makes movies that are dumb movies for everybody. And I don't know what Zack Snyder makes, because I haven't actively tried to watch a Zack Snyder movie since Watchmen that I actually enjoyed. But I think that there's really is something about what Michael Bay taps into that's something on like a primal lizard brain level that you can't help but just, I don't know, it's you just get sucked in. Michael Bay's a real horny dude, I think. Like, and I'm not sure where his horniness lies, whether it's for the military or for explosions. Yeah. There's literally a line in this movie where they're like, we call him Rock Hound. Why Hound? Well, he's horny. And then, you know, most of Steve Buscemi's plot, he's just a smart sex hound. And he just wants to go to the strip club and spend thousands of dollars on, what was her name? Mary Mounds, I think. And there's a whole scene where everybody's talking to Bruce Willis about, like, look, man, your daughter's hot. You just got to accept you got a hot daughter, Bruce.
But at the same time, they're also implying that they helped raise her
as yeah.
like father figures. There's some icky stuff there.
I wouldn't want to see what Michael Bay's search history looks like. I'll say that for sure.
He's the one who's got all this stuff on front pages now.
People who don't know what Michael Bay looks like physically, he's actually a really tall guy. I think he's 6'5", 6'6". He's super muscular. So actually, pain and gain, he goes to the gym all the time. A bit of trivia I found out that was really interesting was Michael Clark Duncan, who's in Armageddon and would go on to be in The Green Mile. Michael Bay discovered him at the gym. They were both working out together. Yeah. And Michael Bay said, come be in Armageddon. So, I mean, and Michael Clark Duncan was a great, like, fun actor.
Right,
so
I reverse every stance I have about Michael Bay if he discovered Michael Clark Duncan. He's a treasure.
I can pardon Michael Bay for that. That's great.
So there you go. So we have Michael Bay to thank for Michael Clark Duncan. But my point being that, so Michael Bay is actually a pretty testosterone-y looking dude. Whereas the usual director, think Martin Scorsese, Spike Lee, Steven Spielberg. I mean, what is usual? That's probably unfair. But there is a stereotype of
looks like the three of us.
Right, I was going to say, there's this stereotype of the nerdy director who sort of only has control on the set and it sort of is like Napoleonic in some way, whereas Michael Bay is actually probably type A, aggressive, sort of Midwestern dude testosterone. So I guess all I'm getting at is there's no surprise if his personality follows that his movie making would be of that mindset versus other things. But Edwin, you were so happy we were throwing Armageddon. You said something to me that made me laugh where you said, finally, some real cinema when I told you we had programmed Armageddon. And I want to say, Edwin, I think that your reaction was modeled in how many people came. People loved Armageddon. So in this podcast, we may be getting critical, but a lot of people love Michael Bay films. So
what makes Bay great is his usual trademark shots where the camera pans out to the dudes for an intense shot. That's in pretty much all his movies. The first Michael Bay movie I've ever saw was The Rock, and that's why it's one of my favorite movies by him. Because Nicolas Cage is awesome, Sean Connery is a badass, Ed Harris is great. This is a fun minor Bay movie. I said this on Saturday that Armageddon was, you know, the launch of the Bayham, in my opinion. That's how I see it, because it's nonstop action, nonstop, you know, American, you know, it's just nonstop Bay. It's all in the movie right there.
2.5 hours nonstop Bay.
Exactly. And then after Armageddon, he went on to do his Titanic, which is Pearl Harbor. I was up 6 o'clock in the morning finishing garbage. But some of the action scenes are pretty damn good, except for when the Japanese attacked the hospital, which never happened. He just put that in there just for, you know, show.
Manipulation.
And yeah, that too. And I don't like Transformers, but I did enjoy the first one. I stayed away from all of them because, in my opinion, they're not that good. Bad Boys 2 is literally my personal favorite of Bad Boys because it's the best one, I think.
I actually, of the three movies I've seen, The Rock, Armageddon, and Bad Boys 2, I may actually be coming around to Armageddon a little bit, Edwin. I did find it a super enjoyable film.
It is enjoyable.
Yeah, I could totally see, like, my family just wanting to chill and putting on Armageddon and just eating, like, In-N-Out burgers or something and having
and
a great
freaking
time.
Freaking out because it never stops.
But I will say that Bad Boys 2 is a guilty pleasure because Michael Bay knows he's making a ridiculous movie, and the movie is ridiculous. So it embraces its aesthetic. And so I watch that, and by the time they're, like, crashing through some village in Cuba to get to Guantanamo Bay, or, like, there's some Russian drug dude who, like, has dynamite strapped to his body, and Michael Bay does a 360 shot around him in a club, and he's like, I'm gonna blow. And I was just like, this is ridiculous. And that kind of acknowledgement of ridiculousness, I loved the whole thing between Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. Yeah, like all that stuff. It was just like a buddy cop movie on cocaine, on more cocaine, that knows it's on cocaine, that's looking to score cocaine. And I thought, like, you know, I was like, there's something about that that's just crazy and gonzo. But when he doesn't have that acknowledgement of the ridiculousness of something, I'm not as into it, because he's talking about things. And anyway, I don't know what else to say. I just like Bad Boys 2. That's all I was going to say. What other Bay films have you seen?
Pain and Gain, and then Transformers 1 and 2.
But what are your thoughts on Transformers? Because that became like Bay's series. It's funny how all these directors now suddenly are on a movie series for five movies, and that became Bay's.
I mean, like I said earlier, Transformers is so strange to think about, because I think the first time I saw it, you know, it was in theaters, so I must have been, what, 12 or 13 when it was out. And a lot of the stuff that I watch as an adult and see now, primarily all of the military tie-ins that are in the movie, it just kind of glosses over a teenager. You know, I wasn't really equipped to see and get that stuff and understand what he was doing. But now, watching it again as an adult, I can see, like, okay, yeah, clearly he's doing the standard Bay move of making something that's got a lot of spectacle and doing these very commercial, you know, a lot of moving cameras, colors very specifically set. The action scenes in that are actually a little easier to follow than in Armageddon, because there are at least robots that are different colors, which is nice. But it felt so weird to rewatch that and Transformers 2 and see just how far, like, it's no surprise to me that it was released at the time when we were going into Iraq and Afghanistan, because it's very much like, join the military, you know, go fight for your country. Listen, we got these alien robots to fight for your country. Okay. Maybe if you do that, maybe if you do something like that, maybe Megan Fox will come make out with you and you're in a car. Maybe. Who knows? As far as my rankings go of like what I've seen, Pain and Gain, I think, is the best of the ones I've seen. Armageddon, it's sitting with me and I'm reflecting on it, and it's fun, right? It's ridiculous.
But it kind of knows it's ridiculous.
Exactly. Yeah. It knows what
sort
it is.
It's forgivable. For
it's
that.
Got such a good cast.
Yeah. Buscemi's great. Billy Bob Thornton, Bruce Willis, even Ben Affleck, who I don't typically like in stuff. I liked, at least, you know, he's playing what he is in this, and you know, he's got
a little Owen Wilson.
A little Owen Wilson, just a little slice, a little splash of Owen, Michael Clark Duncan.
I remember when I was a little kid, I was born in 77, so Top Gun came out and I was 9. And it was a movie that I think when we all turned 10 a year later, a lot of my friends would rent on VHS for their birthday party. And I didn't like or dislike it. It just wasn't for me. I remember being at birthday parties and being like, I'm going to go talk with your parents, like Top Gun again. So I don't even know how I want to frame this question, but there's something a little unsettling about things being made for young, impressionable folks, that there's something intentional happening where they don't want you to be aware that something propagandistic is happening, that they're actually trying to, like, get you to be pro something and maybe enlist in something or do something. And when you see Top Gun later, you know, you're like, wow, that was just an hour and a half commercial for the Air Force. You know, and you can love it, and there's a lot to like about Top Gun, and there's the whole weird homoerotic subtext and all that. But
homoerotic? Those are Navy men.
So when I see movies from World War II, because I love John Ford films and Frank Capra movies and Howard Hawks movies, even as an adult, I'm not bothered by them because I supported World War II. I understood why we had to fight that one. So when I see them saying, hey, guys, we have to sacrifice, we all have to stop wasting resources, you know, we got to go fight fascism, I get it. And I'm like, I don't have an issue. But as an adult with Iraq and Afghanistan, which I feel were both misguided in how they were handled, I get very sensitive to it.
If there's anybody who the military should contract to make propaganda movies, it's Michael Bay, for sure. Like, I think there's no surprise to find out that Michael Bay's most recent works are a movie about Benghazi, and that there's such military influence in his other work, and especially in Transformers.
And didn't he just do a Ryan Reynolds movie that was about the
Six
CIA.
Underground, I think is what that one's called. But finding out, I had no idea that Michael Bay was primarily a commercial director before he'd gotten his work in blockbuster films. And it's interesting because I followed the work of, when I was in school, the commercial work of like Michel Gondry and David Fincher and Spike Jonze. And the way that they're actual films have been made compared to their commercial work, you can see that the tone is still the same, where it's got like, you know, for Spike Jones, there's a little bit of like chaotic energy to it. There's some comedy there for sure. In Michel Gondry, it's got always, of course, the quirk, and he's doing the stuff with the music videos too, where it's all very elaborate, sort of dreamlike, and he's tapping into this other space. I think Michael Bay is making slick stuff for a budget that is clearly like, it's going to allow him to make whatever he wants. It's like how before football games or other, you know, other sporting events, they have big rollout of the big American flag on the field, and everybody has to, you know, sing the national anthem, and you got your military folks there of whatever branch coming to collect their honor medallion or whatever, be there, be present for the national anthem, right? It feels very rah-rah, go America, go our military might, in a way that I don't think needs to collide with good action filmmaking or good blockbuster filmmaking. Like, I think that if Michael Bay wants to, I would be interested to see a straight up pure Michael Bay war movie. Even Edwin, our resident Michael Bay lover, thinks Pearl Harbor's bad.
It is.
I think the fact that Michael Bay can't make a good war movie about an event that is like the start of such a war that America needed to be
and
in.
And an uncontroversial event for America in terms of how we feel about it. Like, people across all sides of the aisle pretty much agree on the stuff that happened in World War II.
Right. It's much easier to say that was a war that we should be involved in, and we should have been, because there's no question about it. But Michael Bay's taken a stance on things that there's a lot of questions about, and that's the part that's concerning.
Like NASA. You know what NASA stands for? Never a straight answer.
Hey,
I know a movie I like because there's an allowance for ambiguity, or there's an allowance for the complexity or thorniness of things. And I don't think you get that. I think you hit on it. Because when I see a filmmaker like, I know this is ridiculous, but like Aliens is about space marines. But in that movie, the space marines are shown to be a little too gung-ho. They don't know what they're getting into. They're being led by somebody who has no battle experience. And the people who have battle experience are the least likely to want to fight because they know what they're getting into. So when you watch Aliens, that never triggers me being like, I don't know, this is too militaristic, because it feels like a movie that's talking about both the strengths and the dangers of a militaristic attitude.
Right.
Whereas I don't think you get that dialogue in certain movies. And
Starship Troopers, I think, pulls that off well, too, where it's clearly like, all right, this isn't just showing the things that could lead to like, oh, this is some crazy, we got these bugs who we have to fight. And there's obviously places getting bombed and cities getting blown up. But you also get to see the flip side of like, oh, this is about propaganda. This is about
fascism.
What we tell people. Yeah, exactly. It's fascism. It's about what they tell people in order to trick them into fighting for something that they shouldn't be fighting for.
I love Starship Troopers, and I love Paul Verhoeven. And I don't know how you can see that movie as anything else but a warning about fascism. There's all that great stuff in that movie where they point out that the aliens didn't attack us, that like we attack the aliens, that the aliens are just sort of trying to protect their home planet or whatever. And then at the end, when Neil Patrick Harris shows up as basically Himmler or Goebbels in literally a straight up Nazi jacket, and he puts his hand to the bug, and the last line of the movie is, "It's afraid." You're like, yeah, no joke, it's afraid. Like, human beings are horrifying.
Yeah.
So you get to think about it in a way that I don't know that you're meant to think. I don't know that you're meant to think in some of the Bay movies.
Michael Bay doesn't want you to think. Michael Bay just wants you to watch and be amazed and feel.
And so, Connor, what are some other Bay movies you've seen and thoughts you have?
I listed them all earlier. I don't remember any of them. I remember the robot's balls from Transformers 2. That's it.
So there you go.
Did we ever talk about Space Dementia? Because that made me laugh.
Oh, yeah.
Buscemi goes nuts from Space Dementia.
There's like an episode of Community where they get stuck in a fake rocket ship and Chevy Chase comes down with space madness. And yeah, I thought that was like a joke, but I guess that's a real thing that happened in this movie. Steve Buscemi comes down with, it's specifically space dementia.
Edwin, you're going to get final word here before we go to pop culture and final thoughts. Final word on Bay and the Bayhem.
Bay's a good director. He knows how to make a great freaking action movie, all right? There's some good, there's some bad ones. Transformers, on the other hand, not for me. I hate Transformers. I despise it. The ones Bay movies you should watch are Bad Boys, The Rock, Armageddon, and Bad Boys 2, and Pain and Gain, which I still need to see.
What do you think about the Benghazi movie?
I don't know what the hell that is, but get some Bay in ya, blow shit up, and call some mayhem, and have a slow-mo, and man, just got real.
That sounds like the title of a great Bay movie, too. I would watch that one for sure if it popped up on my Netflix queue.
It sounds like you hate, like, half his movies.
Well, they're not great. Clint Pearl Harbor, which I hate everyone in that movie. I hate everyone with freaking passion. I hate Ben Affleck. I hate his friend. I hate the actresses. I hate the romance. The only thing I don't hate are the action sequences, which are pretty damn good. But I hate everyone with a passion. I want to punch Michael Bay in his damn face. Like, why would you make this movie? Just because it will make money and it's your freaking Titanic, you bastard. So there you go. Macho Michael Bay movie, except for Pearl Harbor. If you watch Pearl Harbor, I will find you. I will punch you in your face and blow your house up.
Okay, I won't watch Pearl Harbor then. I'll wait for Michael Bay's nuanced movie to come out.
Wow, Edwin.
There you go. Yeah, I just went off.
Anything you want to talk about that you engaged with recently in pop culture, and then just tell us more about where we can hear your comedy, about you, and take it away, Jay Light.
So, I mean, the thing that I've been digging a lot recently is The Boys season 2 on Amazon. I started watching, I just moved and I was packing up my old place and watching The Boys season 1 at the same time. I watched the whole season in a day because it's something about it captivated me. And Boys season 2, I think, is doing a really nice job of building on what happened in Boys season 1 from a narrative perspective, but also from a thematic perspective. It adds Aya Cash as another nasty superhero who she's a great actress. I loved her work on You're the Worst, and she's really, really great in this. Anthony Starr is great as Homelander, and Carl Urban is super fun as Billy Butcher. I've been digging Boys season 2. I can't wait to see how the rest of that pans out. I'm also super excited to start Fargo, which I haven't said anything about yet because I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen the first episode, but that's on my queue. I'm super pumped. I love Chris Rock and I love Jason Schwartzman. And Fargo television series has just been top notch from season 1. So I can't wait to see where they go this time. As far as me, if you like movies, and you probably do because you're listening to this podcast, but you want to hear some people talk about why they don't like certain movies, check out my podcast Blockbusting, which is available wherever you get podcasts. It's a podcast where we talk about movies you hate and why you hate them, and occasionally why you love a movie that everybody else hates, as we did with Craig. And I've also got a stand-up comedy album out. It's called Good Guy with a Gun, and it's available wherever you get podcasts.
Jay,
or wherever you get comedy albums, music, all that stuff.
How long is the set?
It's an hour, and it's stand-up, sketches, and roast battle.
I watched some of your roast battle stuff, and I was, like, super impressed. Before we go around to the other pop culture, I don't want to let this moment pass. You're a stand-up comic, and I have an obsession and fascination with stand-up comedians and stand-up comedy. It's something I know that I'm probably not good at, and yet I want to do some open mics, not to be good or to prove anything, but there's just something about my respect for that experience and how intense it is. Let me ask you a kind of a two-parter. The first part is, what do you think it is about stand-up comedy that has made it a perennial for all of human? There's always been someone in every generation or group of people who do what you're doing, who start to talk about the culture and make jokes and maybe annoy or anger some people, but get people to think about it differently. And they're doing it with no help from anyone else. So you either succeed or bomb on your own musicality and humor.
I mean, I love stand-up comedy. It's what drives the rest of my creative engine. I've been doing stand-up almost 10 years now. You know, this year's been really weird for live performances, especially too, given that we had to basically shut everything down and go piecemeal since March. But live stand-up is starting to come back in safe settings, and it's nice to know that the form is still there. The form is going to stick around. It's continuing to evolve. I think now is a really interesting time to be a stand-up comic because you have a much greater potential of different finding an audience and curating an audience that is really attuned to the kinds of stuff that you want to talk about. That's something that I really think we in 2020 and beyond have an advantage over other stand-ups who come before us, even though there was another boom in the 80s. Then now is the time that I think is really like the diamond age for stand-up.
And the B part of that question is, and I know this is dumb, so you can just be like, F you, go on to the next person and I'll cut it. But who do you think are some of the great, who are like, you know, when I'm a movie maker, so people will be like, who are directors that you love? You know, who are the directors you're obsessed with? And I can name my top three. Do you have a few stand-up comedians that for you are your sort of your Mount Rushmore?
Like Gallagher.
Yeah, big fan of Gallagher. Carrot Top for sure. No, I love one of my all-time favorites, Bill Hicks. I think is great. He's a great comic and also a really great social critic, which is very hard to pull off and not come off as too preachy or claptery. And the way he does it with like Righteous Fury, I think is great. Rantney Minor is a pantheon album for me. I love Dave Chappelle. I love Kyle Kinane is one of the comics who I love, who not everybody might be aware of. I think he's fantastic. He's clearly got a great literary mind. His writing, his joke writing is so intricate and layered and deep, but so funny on top of all that. And that is another very difficult thing to pull off. So those are, if you do nothing else, listeners, go check out Kyle Kinane for sure. He just had a new album come out called Trampoline in a Ditch. But those are some of my favorites. Anthony Jeselnik, I love really good joke writers. I think joke writing is my favorite aspect of stand-up. So any comic who's a really solid, good craftsman when it comes to joke writing, that's it for me. That's the top of the pops.
I'm a huge Bill Hicks fan too, Jay. And I've never heard someone, except for Pryor, who could be simultaneously hilarious and kind of confrontational in a way that I think most people would shy away from. One of my favorite jokes of his was this joke you've probably heard where he talks about doing a set in the South and he was really bagging on Christianity. And at the end of the set, these guys came out in the parking lot and they were, hey, we didn't like your jokes about Christianity, Mr. Hicks. We didn't like you bagging on Jesus. We're Christians. And he's like, oh, okay, so forgive me.
One of my favorite Bill Hicks jokes is he's talking about being at a Waffle House. He's reading a book, and the waitress comes up and says, what are you reading for? Not what am I reading? What am I reading for? Huh. I guess I'm reading so I don't become a waffle waitress.
He was, and you probably heard this one too, and I'll stop. You can't do it like him. That whole thing where he goes off on people's kids not being special. And you're like, that whole audience is filled with parents. And he just goes off and he's like, I know you think your kid's special, but I'm telling you they're not.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the first time I ever booked a commercial, and I thought back immediately to Bill Hicks' bit about how if you would work in advertising, you're not an artist, you're off the artistic roll call forever. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I need the cash. I need the money to be the voice of a dog in a Bagel Bites commercial. I'll take that.
Yeah, dude, Gene Hackman took money jobs, and he was Hackman.
I think there's a nuance.
True. Here. Yeah. Hey, Nick Cage is taking money jobs. He's Nick Cage. Right? Can't hate on it. He's still an artist, an artiste.
Took a trip to NoHo. It was a weird place, man. Weird. I'm talking about strange. I don't think I'll ever go back there again. Went to a place called Game Dude. Picked up some movies. A game, which I'm currently playing right now. Playing Halo, the collection. I'm already killing some aliens. You know, saving some Marines. You know, blowing shit up. I was gonna do a little Woody Allen marathon. I watched Love and Death. I would just say, hey, I watch a Bergman movie because it's basically a Bergman movie. So suck it, Craig. And I saw
that
What's
doesn't
up,
count,
Tiger
Edwin. I love Love and Death. I love it. That doesn't count as a Bergman movie.
I don't care. I don't care. I said it. All right, it's Bergman. Okay, I don't care. I also watch What's Up, Tiger Lily, which is hilarious. Has a kick-ass soundtrack by the Love and Spoonful, and I'm just here. Drinking my Coke, sitting in my chair, about to watch more movies and kill more aliens and save the world. Bay style, man.
I did nothing interesting this week. You can watch me stream video games at twitch.tv/ConnorCruz. I'll use my time to say more aggressively what Craig always says, which is vote idiots. You know, you might not think voting affects you, but it does. And more importantly, it affects the most vulnerable among us to the point that I think not voting is a moral failure. So
vote local. Do your research.
Yeah.
I know I've devoted my pop cultures to this, and I was thinking this week. So you guys know this. I'm a mutt, but I'm predominantly Irish and Russian. And there's something in those genetics make me realize the next month's just an all-out street fight. I think it's a little quaint when people are like, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe this is being pulled out. I can't believe. And I, you know what? Get over that. It's going to be an all out street fight. You know, the best thing about this, the note of hope I could give people is if you vote, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what they throw at you. If everybody just gets out there and votes, then you can do something. You really can do something. I think what I notice politically, whatever side of the spectrum you're on, is there's a lot happening right now to discourage people, whether it's saying, hey, maybe, you know, don't do the mail-in balloting, or it's, oh, we're, you know, we'll discourage you because your person isn't going to get on the Supreme Court or whatever. Discouraging people to vote is another way to win an election. If enough people don't vote, then the other side wins by default, whatever side is doing it. So how do we get a big declarative decision that this is what the people want democratically? Tune out everything you're hearing. Do the research, like Jay said, and just vote. Just get out there, fill out your ballot, go to your polling place. Don't let anything discourage you.
And somebody discouraging you to vote that sounds like they're from your side could be from the other side trying to trick you. That is a thing that happens.
Yeah, and I going with that, Connor, that's why I'm just saying, just vote. Just vote. Whatever, any, just vote. That's the way that you win. No matter what happens, just vote. The states that look really intensely in play right now, and no one ever knows, but the states that look really intensely in play, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Florida, are almost certainly one of those or two of those states will be the hinge states. So if you know folks in any of those states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, or Florida, just make sure they're registered to vote. You know, make sure they know when the deadlines are, and just call them, help them out, vote.org, and that's it. So it was wonderful to have everybody on here. Thank you for talking cinema in the world. Guys, you can find out about everything we're doing on secretmovieclub.com. Please go listen to Jay's podcast, Blockbusting. We are kicking off October. We're going to do a bunch of, we hope, fun, different, varied horror movies and family-friendly Halloween movies. And you can find out all about it, secretmovieclub.com or Eventbrite, Secret Movie Club. And you can email us, community@secretmovieclub.com, podcast@secretmovieclub.com. Jay, any final thoughts? Take us out.
Hey, go watch Tenet at a drive-in, because it's worth your time to go see a Christopher Nolan blockbuster instead of another Michael Bay blockbuster on Netflix.
Now do our famous outro.
It was movies.
All right, guys.
Thank you to everybody. Have a great week. Thank you, Jay, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Edwin, I got a business proposition for you.
My DVDs, I'll kill you.
No, not selling. Listen, homie, you're going to love this. First off, we're going to get you a tax shelter because we're going to declare your room a video store. Then we're going to rent your DVDs. If anyone busts your DVDs, you get a new DVD. And we're going to give you 5% of the proceeds. 95% are going to go to Secret Movie Club. What do you think?
How about no to all of that? I just watched some movies for myself.
Okay.